Good evening. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education here at the Modern, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. This has been a great series. I don't know if you're all familiar, but we have 10 lectures in the fall and 10 in the spring. And I hope that you have been able, some of you have been able to take advantage of a few of the lectures this fall, and I want to encourage all of you, even if you're new to this program, to be on the lookout for the winter-spring schedule on our website, which is just www.themodern.org. Or as members, you will, of course, receive mailings that will give you that schedule in the calendar and the program brochures. So be on the lookout for that. We have a great lineup that begins in February as well. Tonight, of course, is our last lecture for 2008, and we are closing the season in a grand way with the artist Laura Anderson Barbata, who is here with her entourage from New York, where, as I understand it, she lives and works part of the year, dividing her time between New York and Mexico City, as well as the various locations that her art takes her. We will learn more about it tonight, but it seems that much of Laura's work is project-based, and therefore she goes to where the project needs to be. This includes the Amazon of Venezuela, southern Caribbean, Norway, throughout Mexico, and of course projects in and around New York. For example, her collaboration with the Brooklyn Jumbies, who are with Laura this week to present Jumbies Fort Worth, which will be here at the Modern in the lobby at noon this coming Saturday. It's described as a multidimensional collaboration led by Laura in collaboration with the Brooklyn Jumbies and Amphibian Stage Productions. Jumbies Fort Worth's focus is, like much of Laura's work, social as well as artistic. In this case, West African stilt walking is incorporated in dialogue with contemporary art practice. So I'm encouraging all of you to bring the kids and those young at heart, and don't miss this great opportunity this coming Saturday, again at noon. Last year, the Brooklyn Jumbies, just to note, led by Laura, performed Jumbie Camp at the MoMA in New York. And it received great critical acclaim there, as well as their performance in Chelsea, which, if I'm understanding correctly, and maybe Laura can correct this if I'm wrong when she gets up here, that there is, in fact, there was television coverage of their performance in Chelsea that was on CBS. So I don't know quite how to look that up. Maybe go online and look for that. In addition to her collaborative work, Laura is known for her photography, video, drawing, sculpture, and installations found in collections including the collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, the Museum of Modern Art in Mexico City, and the Marco in Monterrey. But since 1992, Laura has worked primarily in the social realm, which is, of course, the subject of tonight's presentation titled Art in the Social Realm, for which Laura is going to present her work and talk about the way it has taken her from the conventional studio practice to an engagement with her surroundings in order to develop artistic projects. One such project is her work in the Amazon of Venezuela that resulted in an exhibition and book titled Terra Incognita, Social Interventions, for which Guillermo Santamarina, the director of the INBA in Mexico City, wrote, "I am convinced that Laura's intelligence, sensibility, delight, courage, and her sheer patience take her in a direction far removed from abjection. I am also aware that her work effectively builds a space for an authentic salvation, hers and that of many others, and generously so." And I think it is with that quote that I will ask you to join me in welcoming Laura Anderson Barbata.
Thank you very much. I hope I learned the lessons of PowerPoint. I'm still trying to learn all the other lessons of life, and I really want to thank all of you for coming here. I know it's very comfortable at home. And but it's very exciting for me to be here, and I want to thank the museum, the Modern, of course, Amphibian Productions, because they brought us all here, and the Jumbies, Brooklyn Jumbies. I'm so honored to be sharing a space with and to be able to work with. So anyway, let's get to talking fast so that we can get to all the more fun parts. So art in the social realm is still the subject that in a way is being defined, and it's defined every day through our work, through the path that we take, through the decisions that we make as artists. I started my work in more of a conventional way in the studio and felt that it really was needed to touch on those things that touched my life, and I couldn't do it from my studio. So I'm going to jump around a little bit in terms of the timeline, but I just thought the sequence worked. Anyway, this is a project in the Bronx where I was asked to create something through art that would draw people into the woodlands, because nobody would go into that part of Wave Hill. I don't know if any of you are familiar with it. And so I took a walk and decided to do something very simple, which is usually what I try to do. Simple, but it's usually pretty big. I decided to cover all the paths of the forest with flowers. So every 3 days I had to go take fresh flowers plus dried flowers and paper. And what happens there is that when you walk the paths, you were of course drawn by the colors and wanted to go into the woodlands and explore, but you also found yourself not just seduced by the color, but more aware of yourself, because when you are stepping on flowers, the sound is different, the smell is different, and you start to think about how every step you take is taking you somewhere new. But at the same time, it's a path with other where other people have walked. And that, to me, is very important, is to shift our awareness of what we normally do in an automatic way and maybe have something make us think about the consequences of all of those actions, which my mother, who is here, taught me so well. This is an action piece I did in Canada. I was invited to do a residency there, and I decided to create a piece that was in dialogue with a body of water. So we communicated through shapes, leaves, and movement. I began working in the Amazon of Venezuela in 1994. I was invited to go there because one of my pieces, a painting, had won an award that was Echo Art, and the award was not only the award, but the money, but also they were going to do an edition of lithographs. So they invited me to the studio, a wonderful full studio in Caracas, and once I was there, I wanted to go somewhere else, and I asked my friends, where should I go? Other artists, and they said, you need to go to the Amazon. There's people making sculptures, which is what I was doing in those days, that are very similar. They're making utilitarian objects very similar to your sculptures. So not being an outdoors person, I'm from Mexico City. I'm, as we call ourselves, a flower of the pavement. I embarked on this escapade into the Amazon, and not knowing that even repellent is necessary. So it was a really shocking experience, and I thank my friends for not telling me that I needed to take repellent and cheese, because without it, the intensity, I mean, if I had been prepared, the intensity wouldn't have been such. As I flew through the Amazon to the heart of it, where the Yanomami people live, these are some of the images. We have our notions of what the Amazon is, and we have, of course, especially during the 90s, a great deal of promotion as to Amazon. Amazon rainforest was big. Anything with the word Amazon, including Amazon.com, was very popular and is a big moneymaker. So our notions of Amazon, of course, are informed by a lot of commercial interests. They're informed by Hollywood, by romantic notions of a primitive self, all the things we know about. And so these are some of the things I encountered and I found myself facing these deformed notions and romanticized notions of what it is. Now, that does exist. Yes, all those beautiful things do exist, but there's also all of this. Now, this is what an area looks like when it's been mined for gold and illegally done so in the Amazon, as all of you know. The place is depleted of all life forever, and these big holes are left. So there's a lot of that going on. There's also a new dependency on outside things, and there is no use or tradition of dealing with trash. So you encounter this. Of course, religious interests are there, and many of them are doing a very good job, and many are not doing a good job. So there are all of these situations as well. The political interest, just like in this country, campaigning goes to remote places. When I first started going, you never, ever saw any kind of campaigning going on in the indigenous villages. Through the years, I started to see these things. Now, these pintas, we call them, these slogans that are for the two different rivaling parties were painted by the people that are campaigning as well, because they found that the votes in the Amazon are very valuable and many times create a lot of problems, because they go into these areas knowing full well that the people are not have not had an opportunity to have any information about who these parties are and offer them food, T-shirts, in exchange for a vote. These areas that I go into have no electricity, no way of reaching unless you come in with a military helicopter, or I was lucky enough to be able to, I can tell you the details of how I got there, or by water. So military interest is high there. Of course, the border with Brazil, with Venezuela, adds to it. This is one of my photographs. the reproduction isn't the best, but this is the community where I have been working, in the Yanomami. It's called Platanal. And here you can see a visit, an early visit by the military. The military don't even know, at that time, did not really know the territory so well, so they relied greatly on Yanomami people to show them the terrain and the area. Through my traveling through the Amazon, and of course in dialogue with the people there, I went to visit their schools. This is one of them. You can see that the people hold on to their traditional way of living through their homes, but they're also learning to read and write, and they're bilingual, speaking Yanomami and Spanish. This is a typical Shapono home, which is, there's no walls between one family and another, and all of the people's belongings are right there where you can see arrows, bows and arrows. You see, right here. And the families are divided, the hammocks go around a fire. Here you see one family. Here you see what would be the living area of another family. Sometimes the hammocks can be in two, like two tiers, one and below. This is what I saw. I felt I wanted to do something. I felt the need. I felt that I was more valuable dead than alive, really, to the earth if I didn't do something productive. So talking to the people and with the knowledge I had, talk to them. What are your needs? And the school was the place where the need seemed to be the greatest, because the kids don't have notebooks, and when they The government sends them one notebook per child per year. When they run out, or it came in too late because of the weather, or it rotted, or the bugs ate it, there's no school. So I realized at that time that you have all the resources around you to make natural fiber papers, and that they don't need to depend on the outside to make paper, to have their schools supplied, and to have an education. Reading and writing is very, very good for them. So, and I decided to start studying to just to observe the way things are done and the way problems are solved and the way utilitarian objects are produced. So from that, create a style of papermaking and bookmaking that is easy and does not depend on the outside. So this is, the earlier is, of course, the gourds that are used for drinking. This is a bread, the way it's sifted. The basket seemed like a nice idea for the papermaking molds. Also, the stitches that are used on the outside of the basket are made of a fiber that I wanted to investigate for paper making. This is the way that bread is dried, or also on that oven, which are all ideas for paper making. The fibers that are used to make the string that is used outside of the basket is this. It's a type of a pineapple, and it makes extraordinary paper. So I tested with numerous fibers. There, I have probably, well, from what I know, the largest investigation of tropical fibers and their response to papermaking. And one of the reasons points in which the dialogue began with the indigenous Yanomami and Yaquanes, I wanted to learn how to make a canoe. And they said, okay, that's fine, but what are you going to teach us in exchange? So that's how we decided I was going to learn how to make these. And they were going to learn how to make paper so that they could make their own books. And see, this is one of the canoes I was working on. I never became good at it. No, it's really hard. Here we are making paper. This is the young boys who today are very active in the project and are the project leaders of the paper making project that goes on without me, so it's independent. We're taking the fibers to the river to soak so that we can make paper. These are banana stalk, and as you know, once the banana tree gives the bananas, that's just trash is left, so we could use that. I teach in a way in which I teach one person, and that person immediately is to share his knowledge or her knowledge with the others, so that knowledge becomes theirs. I am opposed to those dependencies that I could be creating without wanting to. And so, as an artist, you have to continually be asking yourself if you're doing it right. Here's the kids with their paper. And the printmakers. Javier, who is right here, he is teaching the kids how to make paper. He's today 22 years old and is the leader of the papermaking project, second in command. And they have a cooperative organized, and they just received a huge grant from the government. And it's really wonderful the way this project has developed all by itself now. This is the leader, Hakihiwe, printing. Women are involved in the project as well, of course, and they're using right here, these are the traditional drawings that they use for face painting and for painting baskets. The stitch that they used on the side, on the spine, is the same stitch that's used on the sides of the baskets. This right here, the spine itself, is an arrow that is that's broken. Also, this paper project came to solve an important problem. Those books that were arriving, those few books, many times were unusable because the information was just incorrect or obsolete for people living in these communities. Also, the missions created a lot of trash, and it was important to find a use for it and not let it just either be burned or continue to
get bugs eating them. Here you see this Hakihiwe and his wife, Amanda. They are they've been working solid in this project. The kids are involved when they feel like it in the school, but the adults are the ones who really take it on. And here is their first book. The idea was so that they can write their book in their own language and not depend on anything. If you go to any bookstore, you'll find a lot of books on the Yanomami, but none are written by them. And I have seen many anthropologists come and go through these communities, and you don't see even a copy of the book there. So I thought that is an important thing that I wanted to promote, for them to make their own books. And here they are making a continuous production of paper. And this is the book that they did, and it's called Chapono. When we walked in, there was a video based on these drawings, an animation, and it tells the story of how they built their first house. This book won Best Book of the Year in 1999 in Venezuela. Then we decided, after consulting with some of my friends who are bibliotecarios, the people who are in charge of libraries, and librarians, yes, they recommended that we do an edition, and because it's such an important book, it's the first book completely made by Yanomami. And it is now part of the collection of the Library of Congress, Princeton University, New York Public Library, Miami University, Stanford bought one. They're still selling them. So here you can see the back and the book. So it has influenced my work in many, many ways. And here is an installation. I was invited to the Biennial of Public Art in also upstate New York. And I decided to create a space in a public area where people walk through here from the museum to the library, and it was desolate. Nobody used it. It was just trees, and it looked so sad and cold. So I decided to fill it with these red hammocks to create an opportunity for people, students, visitors, to sit down, reflect on their lives. It just shifts when you see those hammocks and you sit down on them, you do think about your life. You look up into the trees. And so the ribbons were there so that you could go into the museum and ask for a ribbon and a marker and write anything from a joke, a recipe, a thought. So we had thousands of ribbons by the end of this, and then we would put them up once a week and fill the trees with the ribbons that would blow in the wind. One of the things that happened as well as I presented the project as an option is people said, you're going to have a lot of vandalism, the hammocks are going to get stolen. Same thing they said about the earlier works of the paths in Wave Hill with the mirrors. Nothing happened. People respected them, they appreciated them, they loved them, they rested in them, they enjoyed having their lunch break there. And the title of the piece is Our History is Not Found in a Book, which means, of course, that. And that there's personal stories that will never be known by anyone except ourselves, because I wanted to, like I said, create a dialogue with the library, but also inspire people to think about their lives. Here I'll show just a few pieces that are obviously influenced by what I've seen in the Amazon. This is a small sculpted hand with a pearl. That isn't the name. The word here is one of the indigenous groups that I work with. And like a pearl, all the cultures, no matter how numerous its population, I think are like pearls. This is a piece based on the Popol Vuh of the Maya people. This was a special commission for a museum in Austria, in Linz, and I've taken Bibles in different indigenous languages and made these columns out of paper. Here's a single piece, a detail of that piece. Then I was invited to go to Trinidad. And in Trinidad, I was invited